purchase to themselves a good degree and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus.
Good morning. Don't get excited. I don't have an overhead or anything. This is my teleprompter. I got my notes put together and went to print them, and the font was really tiny, and I couldn't see it, so then I started reformatting, and as Zach and I have discussed before, if your page breaks get messed up, then it's not inspired by the Holy Spirit, so I just decided just to bring it back up here and use it as a teleprompter. Thank you for the opportunity to come here and be before you this afternoon or this morning and talk about these things. I will say it's always hard to follow David anyway for his preparation. Certainly we've had Rick teach these things to us often enough in the last 4 or 5 years that I even feel like we're following him. Nonetheless, the question we have today is who should be a deacon and what should they be doing? And we will compare those things, as was aptly pointed out by Phil here a few minutes ago, that very much you compare the qualifications of the elder and the deacon, and we quickly realize that the elders are supposed to teach and shepherd the flock, and under their care, as has been pointed out, but that the deacons certainly have a role here that is similar in nature. In Acts chapter 2, verse 42, it says, "And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrines and fellowship and in breaking of bread and prayer." The church was all together at Jerusalem at this point in time. There had been a steady growth of the church. The apostles were all there. And everything that was being done was being administered by the apostles. In Acts chapter 4, verse 34 and 35 says, "Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of land or houses sold them and brought the prices of the things that were sold and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man according to his needs." So if the needs came up, as the bills, groceries ran out, the bills started to pile up, they went and sold their stuff, brought them at the feet of the apostles, and the apostles would distribute as they saw the need. So the apostles at this point in time were involved in all aspects of church doctrine and governance, as we see, but it wasn't very long until they realized that they needed to do something about this. And what do? They install other servants of the church to help fulfill those more direct ministry needs. And we see that in Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 6. "Now at this time, while the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint arose on the part of the Hellenistic Jews against..." I'm sorry, problem with technology. I hate it when I roll my own stuff off here. Hang on a minute. Thank you. "On the part of the hell..." Now, there we go. "On the part of the..." excuse me. "On the part of the Hellenistic Jews against the native Hebrews, because their widows were being overlooked in the daily service of food." So we have a physical sustenance issue here. And in verse 2, "And the 12 summoned the congregation of the disciples and said, 'It is not desirable for us to neglect the word of God in order to serve tables.'" So we have a spiritual sustenance issue being raised here. "But select from among you, brethren, 7 men of good reputation, full of the spirit and of wisdom, who may be able to put in charge of this task." So we have the call for spiritually minded men for physically oriented work here. "But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." And the statement found approval with the whole congregation, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith and of the Holy Spirit, and Philip, and Prochorus, and Niceron, and Timon, and Parmenes, and Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch. So you see that they did find 7 men from among themselves. "And these were brought before the apostles, and after praying, they laid hands on them." So we see immediately that these apostles were pretty smart men, because not too far prior to this, a man named Ananias and his wife Sapphira came and laid a partial blessing at their feet, or gift at their feet, that led to a rather tumultuous result for them. So we see in this particular case in time, with this groundswell of discontent, loud complaints, with accusations of ethnic bias, and the things that are about ready to come, these guys say, well, let's lay these at somebody else's feet. In this particular case, they are actually looking up to do the right thing. In this particular case, that fell flat. The bottom line is these men were looking for somebody else to take the blame. Well, somebody else to take the bullet. Nonetheless, in verse 6 it says, they laid their hands on them. And by virtue of this, these men were found to be good men, found to be worthy of the service that would be called, and brought before them. So if we look at this beyond the familiarity of this passage, and we focus on the matter, we see why men of spiritual accolades have to be brought. I mean, look at the heightened sense of emotion. You're not feeding my mom, you're feeding yours. You're taking care of these and not those. There's a fragile young church here. And we can begin to see and appreciate the reason why these men that are being thrust into these positions have to have the ability to deal with them with a great deal of care and compassion. The apostles, they want to remain in the midst of their prayer and the ministry of the word, and so they need men that they can turn these things over to. Men who can take on these roles and men who are trustworthy with sensitive issues to deal with them fairly and adequately and honestly without ongoing oversight of the apostles so that they can do the things which they were called and required to do. So these issues become their business. They are the designees. The apostles are free to disengage from these things, and because they have fully qualified custodians of care for these issues. They should be able to do these things. So although we find here in this passage in Acts chapter 6, we see that these men are never officially called deacons. That is exactly the pattern that we have with regard to the selection and the ordination of deacons. Choose from among yourselves these men. Now, there's a little bit of a difference there we could talk about later, but we say that the elders should be men who desire this work. In this particular case, these are men that the congregation desires to do this work from among them. That's one of the distinct differences that we see here. But we see here that this is indeed the true nature and what we lean on as tradition in the church and scripturally with regard to the office of deacon, how they are selected, and who is selected for these things, along with the reading that we had here earlier. It's interesting to me that what we see is deacons became essential to the church and to the body of the work before the elders did, essentially. They really did. I mean, there was the physical needs of the church in Jerusalem before we even see the first mention of anything called an elder. And there's a couple good reasons for that, obviously, because the apostles were still doing their thing. It isn't until Acts chapter 11 that we actually see, in this particular case, the mention of the first elders as the brethren of Antioch send a gift to the elders in Jerusalem. It's the first time we hear of the elders. We know that Paul and Barnabas were in the first missionary journey, that they were ordaining elders in all the churches as they were doing their ministry and their work. And then we know that the elders' role was rather substantial, certainly in Acts chapter 15, when the issue of circumcision, which was a rather touchy situation with regard to the need for circumcision in the council at Jerusalem, where the elders and the apostles got together and made determination about that rite and whether or not it belonged with Christians as a mandate to Christians. Other than what we see in chapter 6 of Acts, we really don't have tons that gives us any insight or evidence of what the role of in the official capacity of the deacons would be. We do know, it's interesting that men that were of those original seven that were called to be deacons didn't necessarily remain deacons forever, or if they were deacons, they had other interests, other things they were involved in. Stephen, for instance, was a man that was mentioned by name of great faith and of the Spirit, and we know that Stephen became an evangelist and became a very, very significant character in all of the scriptures with regard to the dispersion of the church at some point in time, and he's a profoundly significant character in the early days of the church. If this Philip that we mentioned here is the evangelist, if in Acts is the Philip that was one of the evangelists and not the apostle, then in fact another of the deacons, man full of faith and a spiritually minded man, went off to do work as an evangelist, and was again a man that has some fairly substantial doctrinal truths wrapped around his efforts there. But based on the evidence, but I'm not totally convinced. It's interesting to me because of the precedent set in Jerusalem. These men may or may not have been part of the quote-unquote local congregation. It could be that in this particular case, these men were selected from among them to do something specific, a specific task. At least in that day and time, it could have been that these men were selected because of the diversity of the place and time that they were able to represent the Hellenistic in the Hebrews and to do their thing. And at some point in time, once that charter was complete, that they dispersed with everyone else. In our day and time, what we have is we have the care that the eldership is not overseers of anything beyond the local congregation, and the roles of the deacon is limited to the degree that it is to work among the local congregation under the local oversight. excuse me. So, we've already read the passage that we have in 1 Timothy with regard to the qualifications. Dave did an outstanding job of going through those for the elders, and indeed, the vast majority of those things were in fact requirements of the deacon. There were some 9 particular requirements of a deacon. Like the elders, the deacon must not be addicted to substances, not be greedy or dishonest, to be blameless, to be the husband of one wife, to be able to manage his children and household well. These are all moral qualities of the person who will fill the office. A deacon has to be spiritually mature and above reproach. Simply has to be. The main difference between the elder and the deacon is the scope of their calling, not the character. Again, as I looked at the qualifications that were brought here, I looked at them from this perspective of what we see these things and why they would be applied to a deacon. I will say that I think what we see in the qualifications of an elder should be pursuit of everybody in this room. Everybody here should be qualified. None of us should, because for whatever reason we may be disqualified in one point, should say, thereby I don't have to be qualified in any. That's ridiculous. In this particular case in time, though, we look at why the elder or why the deacon needs to be dignified. They have to be honorable and respectful. Why? Because of the situations they'll find themselves in, because of the sensitivity of those issues that they'll be dealing with. Not be double-tongued. Why? Because it's never good to talk to somebody that says one thing and means another. Those people usually get found out. Usually you find out later what somebody said to you, they said something different to someone else. These things cannot be the case when you go to share your life with people, when you open up your life to people. You cannot have double-tongued, two-faced people, insincere people, operating in official capacity in the church. Not addicted to much wine. A man is disqualified from the office of deacon if he's addicted to anything. Anything. And there's so many things that a man can be drawn into in our day and time. Not just wine. Anything that draws a man in and takes him away from the truths and from the high quality of the office is not qualified. not greedy or dishonest. Obviously, a lover of money is not somebody you give a checkbook with a lot of money in. In this particular case, these deacons often handle a lot of financial matters for the church. It's important that men be spiritually minded, even in financial issues. They will make decisions about drawing down on the congregation's funds. There should be a spiritual dimension to that decision. There should be times where we would not think twice about drawing down below a certain amount because it is the right thing to do. It should be that we are looking to fulfill the laws of Christ first in these financial matters. It is extremely important that these things be the case. Sound in faith and in life, again, David did a great job. But in this particular case and time, the first time I look at this, I think about a little bit, forgive me, but I think about Judas, who was with the 12 because he got to carry the money box. And he was pilfering from the box. Obviously, a man who didn't walk before Christ or with Christ with a good conscience towards what he was doing. And that's really what we're saying here, holding their beliefs with a clear conscience. The behavior of the deacon has to be consistent with the beliefs. And that's exactly what I think is being brought out here. Obviously, blameless, we can leave it along, but a deacon in this particular case, it's interesting that it says that they have to be proved. Now, I don't know exactly how you go about proving one except for the test of time, if you will, being given smaller tasks to be observed in doing things that that are certainly that prove one's loyalty. Obviously, it doesn't matter whether the candidate is an elder candidate or a deacon candidate, because personal backgrounds and reputation and theological positions will all be reviewed and should be reviewed, but they certainly should be what we as the congregation, when we choose from among ourselves men to serve, is part of that evaluation. Not just that they're good with a wrench and they can hike up their, wear a pair of pants and turn a wrench, is that what you said? Okay, that's not the qualifications of a deacon. I agree, concur. Husbands of one wife, David's absolutely right. This I'm going to tell you this, what this comes down to. The math has to be right before God and man. That's the bottom line. In this particular case, if when it comes down to serving in the Lord's church in official capacity, the math's got to be right. And that's where I leave that, because there's a lot of people, there's a lot of men who would be seen by God or man, but not both, to be in the right place. It is not our place. And remember, we serve the brethren. And we serve, and our most important aspect of this is to serve and to help serve, that we all stand before God with good conscience. We have to serve the brethren in such a way that they can stand before God with their good conscience. Managing the household wealth, obviously this is an important aspect. If they can't manage their own household well, they certainly have no right being involved in our lives. Again, I wanted to make this point. These are all a lot of moral qualifications that I think are important. But again, just because one is listed for an elder doesn't mean it doesn't apply to a deacon or vice versa. For instance, the deacon is told that he is not to be double-tongued, as we've already talked about. That's not mentioned for an elder. Is it okay for an elder to be double-tongued? I hope not. I certainly hope not. So while there are indeed a number of qualifications, usually what David went through in this long, exhaustive list, really what it comes down to, what I see in the list that David brought up, of all of those things that we went through line by line, I think the few things that we really, and this is me speaking, but the few things that we really don't necessarily have to ascribe to the qualifications of a deacon would be their vigilance. And when I say that, I use that in context of their oversight, their vigilance or oversight of the congregation, their sobriety with regard to their alertness in that realm, and their aptitude to teach. I think beyond that, personally, unless I'm missing something, that the rest of these things are all fall under one of the others in some way, shape, or form. A deacon has to be a patient man. A deacon has to not be covetous. None of us can be strikers or brawlers. We don't have the luxury of doing these things. These aren't things that we get a free pass on because we aren't serving the church. How's my time doing? How much time we got? 4 minutes, good. Okay, great. So, when we look at the responsibilities of what we see in the deacons, again, it's a hard thing. We've already looked at the only passage we have, and it was to meet the needs of the congregation. And these needs that they were actually pursuing were the logistical or the material needs of the congregation. While the elders now in our day and time are allowed to work as, to focus on the word and on the food and on what the spiritual aspects of what the congregation is to eat upon and to sup upon, the deacons are to make sure that the table is set, if you will, if I may use that term. We only have those clues that we looked at in earlier examples. But nonetheless, the work that we talk here is not just grunt work, if I can use that term. It's not grunt work. We all can contribute to the things that need to be done. This is a position where these things are overseen, these things are taken care of. And oft times you see to their fault that our deacons take onto themselves things that they should share with us. And that's just the sign of a good deacon. Nonetheless, we as participants in the congregation have our responsibilities to see to participate in these things as well. But where the duties do in fact fall are in acts such as benevolence. I believe that in the final day, if we don't have deacons that are acting from a vantage point of love and of the ability to things that they are doing actually serve and relieve the lives of others, then we have the wrong men in those places. Administering funds and assisting to the needs of other people is on the top of that list. And with regard to church finances, I personally believe that the policies of the finances of a church belong to be in the guidance of those things. The direction of those things should be an elder's oversight, but I think the administration of those things belong in the hands of a deacon. And I think that in this particular case, the day-to-day, taking care of the bills, keeping track of the things that need to be taken care of, the supplies and everything that we do, the ability to make those decisions about when to resupply these things, obviously in the day in, day out, no problem. But there are very substantial decisions that are made that money is involved in that needs the oversight of the eldership. There are things we simply do not use church funds for that may have on the appearance the appearance of virtue, if you will. Logistics. The deacons should be available to help in various ways, again, setting the table. The scheduling, we have meetings, we have events that go on, the facilities and the coordination of these things are certainly all things that fall within that realm. Again, not necessarily just turning a wrench, but making sure that they're facilitators of the spiritual result that will come out of their efforts. There is a spiritual aspect to this work, and these men need to be spiritually minded men. So, traditionally, the facilities are a big part of that. I say traditionally because this is something that has morphed into into the norm. There hasn't always been church buildings. There hasn't always been the responsibilities of property. Now there is. These things obviously would fall under that realm. But it's unfortunate when these things become the essence of the work of a deacon. I wish that we would get past the bricks and mortar of the work of a deacon and recognize their contribution to a loving ministry for the needs of the brethren and beyond. So I have a couple points I want to make, and then I'm going to get down. I'm probably now out of my time. But I do have several, one of them that Randy mentioned a minute ago. While I have the platform, I want to make the point that the office of deacon is not necessarily a training ground or career path for an elder. We shouldn't look at it like that. Many men are impeccable spiritual qualified men, but they lack the aptitude to be a good deacon. Men can have a particular set of skills, be great money managers, for instance, and still be a poor candidate if the specific needs of the congregation aren't that skill. Because a man can turn a wrench doesn't mean we should give him a checkbook. These kind of things have to be brought into the consideration. Many deacons that serve very effectively in the capacity of deacons will never desire the role of an elder, and we should respect that. The congregation should respect a nominee's right to decline their participation in these things without explanation. And a man's desire to hold the office or position shouldn't be the only driver behind that pursuit. We should be concerned if that is the case. And finally, the office of deacon should not be a consolation prize for an unqualified elder. I think these are important points to bring into our consideration. I took it of my liberty to make them part of mine because the deacon's position is often thought of in many of the ways that I've brought up here. And I believe that it's, dare I say, scriptural that these things be brought up in this. Thank you for your time.
What a blessing.